Hi everyone, Michael here. Thanks for tuning in. Before we get started, I wanted to give a special shout out to Zurai H and Linda S, who wrote our first two comments on Apple Podcasts. Thank you guys so much. We'd of course love it if more of you would do the same, as it helps other people find us. So on whatever podcast platform you're using, give us some stars, write some comments and feedback, and let other people know about the show. Who knows, you may even hear your name in a special shout-out on the next episode. Obviously, we'd also really love it if you shared us on whatever social media you use, so thanks in advance for helping us spread the word. Next, a heads up. At the end of this episode with Randy Altshuler of Xometry, Marco and I have appended our own conversation about the company and the idea. We did the same for episode 2 with Dipanwita Das of Sorcero, and people seem to like that, so we'll try it again here. So right after this short spiel, you'll hear our short intro, and then about 40 minutes of conversation with Randy, followed by about 20 minutes of me and Marco discussing the implications. As always, we value your feedback, so send us a note at info@m4edge.com and tell us what you think. But for now, enjoy learning about Xometry and the future of manufacturing in episode 3 of M4Edge.
We want to make them more profitable. We want to make them faster. We want to make them more accurate. Yeah, I mean, everything that's good for them and the customer. This is a rare marketplace where both sides can win. Often in a marketplace, you're basically pushing down the supplier and his price or her price to satisfy the buyer. In this case, there's so much inefficiency in the market and there are so many tools that we can bring to bear. We can actually make it cheaper for the customer and make it more profitable for the supplier.
Hi, I am Marco Annunziata, and welcome to M4Edge. Michael, what's the long name again?
The long name is Annunziata. The long name of the podcast is Macro, Micro, Michael, Marco, and Startups at the Edge. I'm Michael Leifman, and today our guest is Randy Altshuler of Xometry. In case you're wondering, that's Xometry with an X.
Xometry combines two business models that have come to define our new industrial age. One of them is all the rage lately, AaaS, or as a service, as in SaaS, software as a service, or in Xometry's case, MaaS, manufacturing as a service.
XaaS, anything as a service, is the generic term. The idea is that instead of buying a good, you purchase the services the good delivers when you need them. Some examples have been around for a long time, like renting a car, but the trend is now becoming widespread. Xometry allows customers to leverage existing manufacturing capacity to get the goods and parts they need, rather than having to invest in additional manufacturing equipment of their own. But other than in rare cases, Xometry isn't the manufacturer, but the matchmaker between customer and supplier.
And here is where the second business model comes in, the platform. Xometry provides a platform, the means to link people or companies that want something produced with companies that are able to produce it. It's like a hyper-efficient market, an economist's dream. It is not too dissimilar from what Amazon does, linking buyers and sellers, or what Uber and Lyft do, linking riders and drivers. But there is more.
Hopefully there's more, because if you guys only dream about hyper-efficient markets, then you're not living a full life. But part of Xometry's secret sauce is in its machine learning algorithms. That is, Xometry is not eBay for manufacturing, taking bids and offers. Xometry figures out what the thing should cost. Its data and algorithms come up with the prices. So what does this mean for the economy? Lots.
Probably a lot more than I can dream of. But first of all, Xometry enables greater production through better utilization of the existing manufacturing capacity. And by connecting large numbers of users, it can yield greater efficiency and lower prices.
And by increasing capacity utilization on production lines, they're maximizing the overall productivity of capital and of labor. But these business models are also changing something else fundamental, the geography of production. The platform as a service model theoretically knows no borders. So if you only had access or thought you only had access to a local or narrow geographic area, or were only aware of certain producers, suddenly have access to a broad network and supply chain or broad customer market.
This is one of those things that has the potential for exponential change to the economy, and major players are noticing. In the days since we recorded the interview, BMW announced that they've designated Xometry as a Tier 1 supplier.
Oh yeah, and did we mention 3D printing? They do that too. There's a lot here. Xometry is definitely at the edge. Welcome to M4 Edge, and enjoy the episode.
Absolutely. Okay, Randy, thank you very much for joining us on our podcast. We're very excited to talk to you. Both Michael and I have a background in manufacturing, so we're very excited about what you're doing. But why don't you start off by telling us and our listeners what Xometry does, how you came up with the idea, and what is the purpose? What problem are you trying to solve? Or as I normally put it, why on earth are you doing this?
Yeah, so, and thank you for having me today on the podcast. Very excited to be here. So, you know, we have this unique opportunity in the United States and around the world where there are hundreds of billions of dollars of manufacturing being done by small manufacturers. And they're spread across our country here and across the world. And for these manufacturers, the long tail of the internet hasn't yet reached them. So we describe them as being landlocked. They're sometimes second, third generation businesses. They have a dozen to 20 customers they've had for a long time, all in the local area. And that is the heart of their business. And when those customers are busy, they're very busy. But when those customers aren't busy, they aren't busy either. They have a lot of free capacity. And these companies have very small marketing and sales efforts. Maybe they have a website. Often they have almost no online presence. And their capabilities, their skill, their capacity is largely hidden from all of the other potential customers around the country or around the world. We describe it as being stranded capacity. And the internet, which is allowed so many small retailers to access customers everywhere, doesn't touch these manufacturers. On the flip side, if you're a customer, there's no central place for you to go to find the best manufacturer to make your parts. You too have your own supply chain, but it's limited to your own experiences. And as new manufacturing technologies get introduced, it could be 3D printing, it could be a new kind of molding, all sorts of different innovation is happening. You don't really know, is that the best way for me to make my parts? What kind of decisions? What are the trade-offs of these different technologies? Because you have your usual set of suppliers who have their usual set of skills. You don't really know in an automated digital way how to access these new technologies you're reading all about. So in some ways, our business is very analog. And with Xometry, we're trying to bring it into the new age and create a digital platform that connects buyers and sellers of manufacturing. And our technology, our proprietary technology, helps create pricing and an entire environment, an ecosystem that enables those buyers and sellers to interact and to create custom parts.
And so can you talk a little bit more about what a typical use case would look like? How does the process work? Maybe if there's a customer whose story you feel comfortable telling, you know, take us through, you know, from the idea of someone reaching out to you or through you to a supplier on the other end.
Sure. So a good example would be BMW. So BMW will come to us to make, it could be parts that are being used on their production line. So it could also be parts that are used as service parts in a car. And these are typically small volume parts that often have quick turn times. They don't hold a lot of inventory of these parts. And so they'll come to our platform, they'll upload CAD files, 3D CAD files.
A 3D CAD file, that's three-dimensional CAD, computer-aided design, or CADD, computer-aided design and drafting file. It's the software encoding of the instructions for how to produce something, what the geometry of the part is, what the materials should be, the processes, the dimensions, the tolerances, etc. It's the computer engineering drawing for how things get built.
And our technology, which we use artificial intelligence, will produce a price and a lead time for them. And it will also tell them and show them in real time the trade-offs of different manufacturing technologies, because it turns out there's a lot of different ways to make a certain part. And some may be cheaper, some may be faster, Some may give you tighter, what are called tolerances, so it's more exact. Some may have a different kind of surface finish. Some may have certain material properties. With our platform, they instantly can see all the pros and cons of these different technologies in real time. And so BMW can go to our site, they can upload these files, they can choose what technology they want, they can choose the, they see the delivery date. There's all sorts of what we call post-processing, so things they need that will make the parts usable in a production environment or end-use environment, and then they can buy. And you can either buy with a credit card, or if you're a company, you can pay with a purchase order. You never have to talk to anybody on the phone. You don't have to go visit the factory. You don't have to think about, oh, well, this guy can do that, and this person can do this. I have to mix and match. No, it's all there for you in one place. Like, if you want to shop for things at Amazon now, anything you can think of is there. And you can press buy and actually buy it. It's not hypothetical. It's real. And it's a real window into the actual pricing and lead times and capacity that's available in manufacturing today in the United States. And boom, you buy. And then with our algorithms, we match that order with the best suppliers available. And we use these matching algorithms to pick the right suppliers, and there's lots of characteristics that we factor into that. And then we create a price for them, and we marry those two prices. We, Xometry, are the person who's connecting the buyers and the sellers, and the transaction is made, and then we monitor the production of those parts. We guarantee the quality, we guarantee the delivery, we guarantee the price that the customer bought them at. All those things happen. And so the customer gets the advantage of accessing today over 2,500 manufacturers at their desktop without having to call 2,500 manufacturers and sort through the pros and cons of each of them. So they get the advantage of accessing all that with Xometry in the end, making sure it happens right, taking effectively the risk out of the equation.
I'm going to tell a little story that, Randy, I told you, I think, when we first spoke on the phone. So going back before XaaS, or everything as a service, was anywhere in the common parlance, and long before Xometry started, I read a New Yorker article. It was 2004 or 2005, about a company called Office Tiger, and I was obsessed with this story. It was so cool. It was about this company that basically invented the idea of business process outsourcing, and it was something that I was really struck by. Fast forward to, I think it was 2016, maybe, when you and I first spoke, and I did a little bit of Googling around who is this Randy Altshuler guy. And all of a sudden, this article comes up from 2004 in the New Yorker, and lo and behold, you're that guy. And that was sort of it was a cool moment for me. And I'm wondering, you know, Office Tiger conceptually is similar to Xometry, right? You are linking suppliers and consumers through a platform in a way that hadn't been really done before. And so, how much of that background of Office Tiger played into your view here of how you built Xometry, or why you built Xometry?
You know, I think the concept behind connecting, finding the optimal solutions for a customer, and in the case of Office Tiger, it was about location, it was about skill set, it was about scale. So it was a different set of considerations, but it was still the same theme, which was, how do I make things in a better way? In this case, it was more of a services model, but how do I provide these services in a better way? The mission of Xometry at the end of the day is for both the buyer and the seller to find the optimal match. So for the buyer, what's the best way to make this? And not only just what's the best way, but who's the best one to make it for me? And likewise, for the sellers, a big challenge for manufacturers is they're being asked to quote work and do work that doesn't fit into their sweet spot, because the customers aren't educated enough. So if you're a manufacturer, you like to cut metal. You actually like to manufacture. Don't want to waste time quoting parts. You want to waste time with administrative stuff. So we can knock that out for you. That's really great. And it was a similar concept in Office Tiger, in the sense of, and in this case, it was removing any boundary of nationality and saying, hey, we're going to find for you throughout the world, whether or not it's in India, whether or not it's in Salt Lake City, whether or not it's in Poland, we're going to find that optimal solution for you. I think that's a very common theme as we become more and more of a globally linked country and economy. I think that theme is you know, resonates with Xometry, and there's a lot of efficiency there. There's a lot of inefficiency in this market, because we're not traditionally, you're not finding the best matches of buyer and seller.
And Randy, you were saying earlier that the key to building credibility has been to show that you can get it done, especially because you're not building the parts yourself. But so how does your vetting process for the manufacturing companies work? How do you find them? How do you make sure that they have the capacity and the quality?
Yeah, so what's been exciting is in terms of finding them, they found us. I think it also goes to, because we have a lot of people on staff who come from a manufacturing background. And, you know, there are Facebook groups of machinists. They're all over. And it's a whole community. They love to watch videos of people cutting parts, of actually machining. I mean, tens of thousands of them do that. So
sounds fun.
Yeah, it's like my son watches other people play video games. He watches iPad. He plays himself. He watches other people do it. So they've been coming to us by word of mouth. The vetting process is really important, particularly because a large segment of our customers are aerospace, defense, automotive, industrial, medical devices. I mean, really important stuff that's in the sky, on the ground, you know, it's in your body. So first there's an online vetting portion. There's an interview portion. Then there's a test, which Xometry pays for. So we'll give you test parts and we'll pay the supplier to do that. And then there's a portion of time where all the work will, before it's sent to the end customer, will come back to a Xometry facility and be tested, approved before it goes to the end user. So that's an extra cost, but we don't feel comfortable until the partner, we call them partners or manufacturers, partners, until they reach a certain point of credibility, they have a certain score, we generate a score, we don't feel comfortable they can direct ship. And then we also tightly control how much work that partner can take and from what kinds of work. And it's all done in an automated way using algorithms, because we do too much volume to sort of do that by hand, things will get lost. But there's a strenuous set and strict set of rules that dictate who can do what when. And that, as they graduate through that process, sometimes they never graduate, but if they graduate through, that's when we get more and more comfortable with saying, hey, it can go directly from you right to the customer, or you're good enough to do this very precise part, or this very quick turn part, you know, all these different gates that they need to go through.
I recall, I don't know if this is still part of the Xometry business model, but I recall that at one point you guys also had your own small manufacturing facility in case you couldn't match a supplier with a consumer's product demand. Is that still part of how you do things?
Yeah, so we consider it sort of more of our lab. So when we started the business, to get our data going, we needed to capture some data. And we needed to, as I was alluding to before, have some manufacturing experts. So we built our own little machine shop. We built our own little 3D printing facility. And we've learned a lot from that. That also makes us more credible with our suppliers. We say, hey, I have actual machinists here. We know what you're going through. So we still have that facility. It's an extremely small part of our network. And it's less about backup, more than about credibility, testing, learning, kind of eating your own dog food. We're going to roll out this feature to our suppliers. Would we as a supplier want this feature? Now our guys hate it. Well, then why would we expect our suppliers to like it? So that helps us a lot. And I think there are other folks who are doing different elements of this space. And I think having the manufacturing chops is important. I think it helps influence your product development, but it's also important for the credibility that you get with your suppliers and your customers.
Are there other things that you think distinguish Xometry from some of the other players that are in this space now? I've noticed that you're no longer alone.
There's a couple of things. So from the customer side, we want to be your one-stop shop. And then on the supplier side, it's about, and some of this I can't really talk yet because we haven't introduced it, but there's a bunch of things we can do to make our suppliers better. So part of our pitch is to go to a BMW and say, hey, listen, you may even have one of our partners on your network. You know, they may already be a supplier to you, but working with Xometry, they're better. If you access them through our platform, they're going to do better for you than if you did it on their own. Can't go into detail exactly how we're doing that, but that's part of our mission, is to make our suppliers better suppliers.
Quality-wise, not price-wise, or what's, are you allowed to, can you divulge any of that?
We want to make them more profitable. We want to make them faster. We want to make them more accurate. Yeah, I mean, everything that's good for them and the customer. This is a rare marketplace where both sides can win. Often in a marketplace, you're basically pushing down the supplier and his price or her price to satisfy the buyer. In this case, There's so much inefficiency in the market, and there are so many tools that we can bring to bear. We can actually make it cheaper for the customer and make it more profitable for the supplier.
You know, let's stay on the concept of this being a win-win situation for both the manufacturers and the customers, which I like a lot. And you started off the conversation by pointing out that from the point of view of manufacturers, they have spare capacity that they can better utilize thanks to Xometry. Talk a little bit more about the users and why they take recourse to the Xometry platform. Is it mostly for prototypes? Is it to complement their supply chain? Do they use it as an additional form of their supply chain? I'm interested because especially when you see companies like BMW or GE, which are large scale, they have strong supply chains, you wonder, what is it that Xometry can offer them?
Yeah, so we're not a contract manufacturer. And when you look at a Fortune 500 or, you know, Fortune 50, I mean, and these, we have a lot of those companies in our customer base. If they're going to be doing contract manufacturing, they're going to build a one-to-one relationship. That integration in their supply chain is going to be seamless. We're not going to disrupt that market. That's very efficient. And we don't want to add noise to that. We don't want to add friction to something that's become as frictionless as possible. I mean, there's always innovation, but it's pretty darn good. And there's lots of tools out there, software tools and tried and true methods to make that work better. But there's a huge subset. In the United States, it's about $80 billion segment of parts that are ordered in low volume that are not production parts. And it's that market that's incredibly inefficient, where the procurement person at BMW sends out an email, even if it's an automated email, to 30 providers and say, hey, here's the specs of what I want. Come back to me before XYZ date with your response. Now, they got to call the people, follow up. They got to answer questions. They got to do all this work. And after a bunch of days and a bunch of cost, they'll finally have some bids. We are effectively an instant RFQ with our system. You don't need to do all that. Our algorithms are telling you what the best market price is today. And if Xometry is successful, our best market price should be better than the price you could ever get, even if you do that 30-person RFQ. And we do that in a blink of a sec. That's really important to the customer. And for the procurement professional, who's our friend, their ability to scale and their ability to get better pricing, better lead times, better solutions without doing all the manual legwork that's required today, even if they have a fancy ERP and procurement system.
ERP, that's an enterprise resource planning system. It's a system that allows manufacturers to track in one place all of the prices, bids, quotes, everything in their entire manufacturing supply chain, all the material, all the labor, all in one place.
Fancy ERP and procurement system, because that's really not germane in these instances. That's a win for them.
I want to go back to this. I've been sort of itching to ask this since the beginning when you said you have this AI algorithm that comes up with the price. So it's not actually a bidding system, right? It's not as if you've got manufacturers on one side saying, I can do it for X, and another guy saying, I'm going to do it for X minus one or whatever. It's the algorithm itself doing the bidding.
I couldn't be instant if that were the case. So I don't have time to pull my network and say, hey, you know, Michael just quoted these parts. What do you guys think? My customer would be waiting around. So I need to find a way to give you an instant price. My algorithms basically are a instant poll and say, hey, I know what our suppliers have done these parts, kinds of parts like this before for what price. I know who likes to do it at this. I know what's the right price, you know, what I can get this done at, what the lead time looks like, et cetera. That's the result I'm going to return to the customer. And that's kind of the magic of Xometry, because using AI, we've gone very wide. If you try to do a cost plus model, then you would never be able to scale the size, which you could do so quickly, and it would be extremely slow. We just have to figure out tool paths and exactly how it was made. And on the flip side, if you wanted to actually get real bidding data, it wouldn't be instant. So the beauty of AI is to mimic that bidding process in real time.
How did you get the data to train the model to begin with, since so little of that bidding data is ever disclosed, right? It's very little of that is public. How did you train the model?
We just did building the data. I mean, it just through running parts, getting orders. I mean, we acquired a company called MakeTime, one of our competitors based in Lexington, Kentucky, a couple months ago. And so they had accumulated a lot of data. So it's just, it's through different means, but it's all data that, that we are, or Maytime have accumulated ourselves.
I assume it continually trains when a guy accepts a bid or whatever. I assume the model reinforces its knowledge.
It does. So we need more, the more data we have, the more we train our models and smarter they get. So it is a lot of it is about scale and the number of transactions we can run. Those are all incredibly important data points for us. Think about the more people that are on Google, the better, the more accurate the search results become, right?
And so sorry to harp on this a little bit, but if you've got either an unusual product or a new product, what's the track record on how accurate you are, you know, based on the expectations of the consumer?
Yeah, we'll eat it. So we have a portfolio approach to our pricing. Sometimes, to your point, Michael, we'll see something we've never seen before. The system won't have seen it, and it'll misidentify it, or it won't really know how to handle it, and it will spit out a price and a lead time. Now, if the price and lead time, unfortunately, are too expensive and too long, the customer won't order. So we don't win their business, which I always don't like, but that's better than what usually happens, which is it's too good. And it underestimates what the true cost is, and or maybe it says it's going to happen faster, and that's when we have to eat it. Because at the end of the day, if you come to the site and you order something that's $1,000, well, actually our software hasn't seen this before, and we misclassified it, it's really a $4,000 part, I'm eating $3,000, you know, big tasty sandwich. Not tasty.
Right. So you take all the downside risk, but because if the price is too high, it doesn't get bought. You don't get the upside risk.
That's right. So if you see the margin on what we do, it's focused in a nice, healthy place, but there are tails on both sides, both some parts where we get really, you know, oversized margins, but there's a healthy tail on the downside as well, where, hey, we don't have enough data. We haven't learned about this yet. We got it wrong and it misidentified. As time goes on, we do more and more of those parts. And as where our system gets smarter and smarter, we're truncating the tail of both sides. It's getting narrow and narrow, because in the end, we really want to have a predictable range for everybody, both our buyers and our sellers. But that takes time. And that's our moat too, though. That's why it would be very hard for another company. We talk about competitors, but they don't really use AI, to come in and suddenly be able to do that, because you have to have a lot of data. And we've had 5 years plus, we've had 5 years of Maytime has been around a similar period of time as we have. We get the advantage of all that data we've generated together.
And Randy, you should be aware that whenever we mention artificial intelligence, Michael gets excited and suspicious. He has dystopian nightmares bubbling up in his mind. So I think I need to steer the conversation a bit away from the algorithm for a second.
My natural stupidity is amazed by artificial intelligence.
And let's talk a bit more about the products. Randy, you were mentioning earlier aviation, healthcare, defense. Can you tell us a little bit more? Is it mostly intermediate parts? Is it mostly industrial products? Is it end user products? Are any specific sectors stronger users than of the platform?
Yeah, so it really is. It ranges. It's the full spectrum, from a quick prototype to an end use product that a consumer will see. So we're more on the B2B side. So I'd say that's what distinguishes us. We tend to do higher complexity work because we do a lot in aerospace, defense, automotive. We do more stuff that's the full, from assemblies, all the post-processing. There's just a lot more work of what we're in our products. And a lot of our tools are helpful for professionals.
So let's begin to broaden this a little bit. We just touched on some of the sectors that you produce for. Geographically, you guys are in the United States only at this point, correct?
That's right. And we do a little work. We'll service some customers overseas, but it's a small fraction.
Do you see a future where Xometry is global, where you're able to tap into a more global, both supplier and consumer base?
Absolutely. You know, many of our customers are multinationals and are asking us to be in Europe or asking us to be in Asia. And so absolutely, we need to be where our customers want us to be. For us, the challenge will be building those local networks. And that's important not only because the transportation costs and lead time costs, but also because every market's a little bit different. The precision expectations in Asia, in Japan, may be very different than they are in Canada. I mean, just making up examples. But those markets can be somewhat different, and those subtleties are important. As we grow global, and eventually Xometry will go global, our platform has to recognize that. It's also a reflection of the kinds of businesses in each of those areas as well.
So if I read you correctly, Randy, you're thinking, or you're envisioning going global with a kind of an islands approach, that is building local networks of manufacturers to serve the national or regional customers, as opposed to having a deeply interconnected global chain.
I think it's fine to have a global chain. And I think as we go global, we'd be happy if somebody in America wanted to access a provider in Asia, or likewise, if in Asia wanted to access a provider in the United States. I think there's so much local capacity available and skill available that, and particularly because we're not doing contract manufacturing, I think a lot of that value is much closer than you think it is. And there are advantages to being closer.
When you and I had talked earlier regarding some applications of this sort of business model to developing countries, you brought up the important point that you need for this sort of dispersed business model and production model. You need reliable power, you need roads, you need ports. It's not that you can just build, you can't plop down a factory in the middle of a forest somewhere. So talk a little bit about that, and presumably you still feel that way, how you think that limits you, or what you think the opportunities are to either, you know, build out countries that don't have that infrastructure, but that do have cheap labor costs. You know, how do you see that developing?
Yeah, well, you know, I can use an example right here in Maryland. So, you know, we have in Maryland, a lot of the power lines are above the ground. I mean, I'm from New York City, so originally, so different infrastructure there. So when there are bad storms, our manufacturers lose power. And we have, as you had mentioned in the beginning, we have our own small little manufacturing shop. We'll actually lose power. And that's here in Maryland, in by the way, in Montgomery County with our manufacturers, one of the wealthiest counties I have to imagine in the United States of America. So I was recently speaking at a panel about manufacturing in Maryland, and I know the state's pushing hard to get manufacturers to come here. And I said, first order of business, make sure everybody has power. And particularly when you're thinking about things like 3D printing, getting a UPS, a power backup is ridiculously expensive. So it's really not, you can't do that. And if you lose power for seconds, you can lose the entire hours and hours of build of manufacturing time on your 3D printer. It's gone. So uninterrupted power supply is critical. Even here in Maryland, it doesn't happen. And it's unfortunate.
Kind of following the same theme, maybe less hypothetically, but from your current crop of customers, is the pull of extra production what gets the factory that has the slack online, or is it the cheaper labor cost in one county or state versus another? You know, what's really at the fulcrum here? Is it the capital cost? Is it just the availability of the production line, or is it the labor cost?
For our customers?
Yeah.
It's about getting the parts. They need those parts. And because most of our customers are established businesses, as we alluded to earlier, they start with us because their supply chain failed. Their go-to vendors couldn't get it done, and that's how they first find us. I can't get it done. They find us on the web. Okay, let me try this solution. So it starts with a problem, and when we can prove to them that we can get that done, that's when they start coming back to us over and over again. And at some point, they say, well, wait a minute. Maybe it's not just for stuff that my own network rejects. Maybe it's for more core stuff. But for our customers, price is always important and lead time is always important, but reliability is certainly the single most important factor, and getting it when you need it. And that's the beauty of a marketplace versus just doing all the manufacturing yourself. You can scale in a way that nobody else can if they're trying to build it all themselves. And so with Xometry, you have virtual access to 2,500 manufacturers. That's pretty awesome. Now, the question is, how do you really deliver on that, and how do you make that accessible? And that's what Xometry tries to do. But if you can do that, then that's a very appetizing solution for a customer.
And there is something you mentioned earlier, which I found very, very interesting and very encouraging. So when I first found out that your supply chain, your manufacturing base is entirely in the US. As an economist, I had an immediate negative reaction. I thought, oh my God, this is something that will actually encourage more protectionism. It will encourage a breaking down of global supply chains. But our conversation tells me this is not true. You were pointing out you are not contract manufacturers, so global manufacturers still need their global supply chain. But at the same time, something you mentioned earlier is that you are creating more demand, more work for manufacturers dispersed across the United States, and therefore creating more certainty, more demand, and so possibly more production, more jobs, and more investment. Should we see Xometry as something that can actually strengthen the fabric of manufacturing and job creation across the US?
Yeah, absolutely. And I am a free trade person. I don't believe protectionism is smart or works. And so at the end of the day, if our network, if Xometry can't give you the value, you, the customer, that you need, then trying to create artificial barriers is the wrong solution, and we will lose in the end. So the trick is, does this American manufacturing base, just we're talking about America because that's where we are today, can that meet my customer needs? When it can, then it's not the best solution. But Xometry, one of its goals is to make it more competitive, not through laws and tariffs and barriers, but through better production, more efficient production, through filling spare capacity, through better matchings of demand and supply. So that's how we think we can get there. That's the best way to get there.
One related question is the issue of what happens to capacity utilization. I mean, the first point you made is you are creating a system whereby the installed capacity of manufacturers in your supply chain gets greater use. Low capacity utilization is inefficient, but it also provides a cushion. To the extent that capacity utilization increases, there is more the risk that if something goes wrong, there's a spike in demand or a disruption due to a hurricane, you might have more significant problems in the manufacturing chain. How do you see this? How do you see the impact that Xometry has here?
You know, I don't think that's necessarily the case. And in fact, I think it's the opposite. As our suppliers are seeing more business, and more effectively their SG&A, their sales and marketing engine, they're beginning to buy more equipment. They're beginning to add more capacity. So anybody, and I have to give my manufacturers a lot of credit. As I mentioned in the beginning, some of these are second or third or even fourth generation manufacturers. They know you can't run your machines at 100% capacity or even 90%. I mean, there is that comfortable number to take into account the inevitable problems that occur just because things happen and you can't control Mother Nature. So I think those manufacturers realize as they're getting more business, boy, I probably need to invest more. And we give them the confidence that they can do that, because even if they're in Texas and they've lived and died with the oil and gas industry their whole lives, and now they see, hey, wait a minute, I can get a whole new stream of business from medical device people in Boston or from a defense contractor in Maryland because Xometry is delivering it. I can go out and buy more equipment.
So this reinforces the point you made earlier that it is a win-win situation. So on the one hand, the users have more confidence and more certainty they can get their parts when they need them with the right quality. And on the other hand, the manufacturers have now more confidence and more predictability in a higher level of demand. And this can therefore give them the confidence to invest more and create more capacity.
That's right. And one of the other benefits we have in our network, so recently we had all this, you know, flooding and terrible weather in North Carolina. We were able to take the work that was being done by our North Carolina suppliers and switch it to people in other geographies. Customer's perspective, that was seamless. They didn't see any problems. And from our local partners' perspectives, the burden of having to do work when your shop was underwater and where it was going to be risking your life to go on the road, but you need to do that, was taken away as well. So it was really a benefit, as much as anything can be a benefit when there's a natural disaster, but it was a benefit for both the customer and the supplier. With a network where you can distribute work different places, that enables that to happen. Otherwise, you're stuck with that one provider, and that's a good, bad thing for both of you when things go bad.
One of the questions I want to make sure I get in is sort of what I'm going to call the philosophical question of this podcast. And when you look at the market, the manufacturing market, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, you know, some point in what for a startup is a very, very far future. How do you see the manufacturing world? Do you think production as a service, manufacturing as a service becomes the dominant form of production? Do you think it's still sort of a niche-y thing? Where do you see this going? How do you see the networks being built out?
I think it's going to become more and more interconnected. So I think networks are going to be more and more important, and they may be in the shape of what Xometry has. They may evolve. I think they always have to evolve, but I think technology is linking that long tail of the internet is reaching manufacturing now, and it will forever change it. And I think in a very positive way will interconnect us. I also think there's going to be, unfortunately, because of climate change, I think there are going to be some other shifts. I think manufacturing is going to have to be more aware of its impact on the environment. I think that's going to dictate some what methods of manufacturing technologies themselves start emerging and which ones maybe get throttled back. I think it's going to be a different world altogether because of those sorts of trends. And I think manufacturing is going to be front and center in that.
Can you foresee a moment when Xometry works into its algorithms the sustainability of process, you know, what the emissions are?
Absolutely. Listen, there is no way that having a $10 package shipped overnight via Amazon from somebody, you know, far away is good for the environment. There's just no way. And again, our job is to empower and grow all these local businesses. But I think certainly location and carbon footprint and the impact that has to be factored in. It's a true cost. And we've all been in such a hurry. We haven't factored that, but it's coming home now. We gotta deal with it.
This has been great, Randy. Thank you very
much.
Okay, thank you guys.
And good luck.
Thanks a lot. Good luck, Randy.
All right,
bye.
Thanks so much.
Coming up in a minute, Marco and I discuss our thoughts on the interview, reflecting on what we learned and the new questions that the discussion triggered in our minds. So stick around.
We also talk a lot more about the strange dreams of economists. No, not really. More importantly, we are also curious to know what you thought. So drop us a line at info@m4edge.com. And if you have any suggestions for future guests, please do include them. Thanks again for listening to Macro,
Micro, Michael,
Marco,
and Startups at the Edge. So Marco, as I'd mentioned during the conversation, I had heard of Randy before. So in maybe 2005, I think that's about when it was, there was a New Yorker article that I was sort of obsessed with about this company called Office Tiger. It was founded by these two guys who had gone to Princeton together, hence Tiger. But basically what they had done was to invent a new way of doing sort of paperwork, a new way of doing the paperwork side of business. By using people in India to get stuff done for you. And so this company, Office Tiger, provided what we would now call a platform with which to connect to other workers. They revolutionized the way a lot of office work in the US and in Europe and in OECD countries generally was done, relying on labor in other parts of the world with cheaper labor costs. This was the beginning of business process outsourcing as a big thing. And of course, the punchline here is that Randy was the guy behind Office Tiger, and he was in this New Yorker story that I was so obsessed with. And, you know, fast forward many years later, and here he is at Xometry with, you know, a business model that's not too dissimilar. It's a platform that connects two parts of the market, the suppliers who produce the goods or the parts that you're looking for with the consumers who are looking for that manufactured part. It's not an office product anymore, but it's an assembly line product. And Office Tiger was successful as a company, but it was enormously successful at business model innovation. And it's one of the things that sort of drew me to Xometry as an interesting company to check out to begin with. And so do you think that this type of manufacturing as a service business model, will be as prevalent as business process outsourcing was? And you think it's going to create the same sort of job market and labor market anxiety that business process outsourcing did?
I don't think it's going to create the same kind of anxiety. It's, I think, that to answer your question, we need to decide whether we fully believe the bottom line we had from Randy, which was that this is a revolution in how manufacturing is organized that will trigger greater production, more demand and greater production, right? Because what I was focusing on in our discussion was the idea that in this case, what you're doing is not offshoring work, but you are taking better advantage of an existing capacity for manufacturing. So I need some parts built. I could build my own plant to do it, but hey, there is another guy down the road that has a plant that can do it, and that plant is not being used all the time, so I can go and do that. And my first concern was, okay, so if this is the case, if this is creating more efficiency through better capacity utilization, doesn't it mean that less investment will be made? Because in some cases, okay, maybe I would have produced less without those parts. In some cases, I would have said, let me invest more and hire more people because I feel demand for my products is going to increase and I do need to build the parts myself. So my concern is not completely, has not been completely dispelled by our conversation, is whether this kind of efficiency can result in lower levels of investment and correspondingly lower levels of employment. Randy was making almost the opposite argument. He was saying, no, this gives companies more confidence that they can get things done, they can get the parts they need, and so it has a boosting impact on activity. I feel like that is still an open question mark.
Right. I can see both eventualities playing out, depending on how much existing slack there is in the particular segment of the manufacturing market, or obviously depending on the risk tolerance of the consumer to invest in a new facility versus outsourcing or versus using the platform. He was adamant that this helps U.S. productivity because it uses existing manufacturing lines. And I think, again, for now, that seems to be the case. I think in the same way that an office tiger helps productivity, even if you are not using a U.S.-based resource, you're still getting something out of it, right? The firm that's the buying firm is still getting some advantage, even if it's no longer producing thing. Otherwise, it wouldn't do it. So I fear that, although I could see Office Tiger being, because it's labor that you're talking about and not manufacturing or skilled manufacturing or whatever, I could see the transition to developing countries being quicker for a thing like business process outsourcing than it would be for manufacturing as a service. But I don't see it. I mean, I see MAAS potentially going that way also, right? I mean, we know that in developing countries, in many cases, they have very high tech manufacturer too, and there's high skilled labor there too. It's a misperception to think that everything built in a developing country is of lower quality. That's just not the case. And so, we said this sort of platform opens up, removes the borders. And I think that's true. If you can get something built in India or China or Bangladesh more cheaply with the exact same specs that you can have it made in Peoria, then why not?
No, I think that's exactly right. I guess it will depend to an extent on a number of parameters. So how quickly do you need the part? How expensive is it to ship it over from one location to another? And plus, of course, the risk of protectionism, putting barriers to some of these production, or so to some of these trading in components. But in principle, I agree with you. So there's no reason why, once you have a platform like this, it should remain limited to sourcing production within a certain radius or within the borders of one country. And I think eventually the maximum efficiency would in fact be achieved by tapping productive capacity across the world. And as you've pointed out, the high-tech, high-spec manufacturing is quickly coming up in a number of emerging markets as well. So that could definitely happen. The other element, though, will be how difficult is it going to be. Let me rephrase this. When you and I in the past have thought a lot about the implications of new manufacturing technologies like 3D printing, and there is a general discussion on whether these technologies can bring us towards the democratization of manufacturing. In other words, the idea that setting up a facility to produce certain parts or products can actually become easier, faster, and cheaper. And if that is the case, then the rationale for either tapping existing capacity in your own neighborhood or going to check out existing capacity in another country becomes less compelling. So I think that's another question mark on how this business model will develop in the longer term future, say in the next 10, 20 years.
Absolutely. So I listened to a podcast earlier today where Ezra Klein was interviewing Mark Sanford, who's a Republican congressman who lost his primary and is he had a kind of infamous past. But he said a few interesting things on this podcast, one of which was about the shifting set of industries in South Carolina, where he's from. And he said something like, you know, we don't want to make buggy whips anymore. We realized that we needed to, you know, bring in high-tech jobs. And so now we've got manufacturers like BMW. He named a few, but BMW was one of the ones he named. And in fact, BMW recently named, as we mentioned in the intro, BMW recently named Xometry as a tier one supplier, right? So what does that mean for the small towns in South Carolina that used to make buggy whips, and you know, now some of them might commute to Spartanburg to make fancy cars? You know, I think it puts them at risk. I think it's, in some ways it's great, and I think it's some ways it's kind of scary. I think the ability for BMW to make their production lines more efficient and theoretically produce Beamers that are either easier to buy or give their shareholders a little bit more retained earnings. That's kind of great for the people that rely on that employment. You know, it gets a little hairy, I think.
Or maybe I agree, but maybe a more constructive way of looking at it is that it's something that might push smaller towns like this towards a different, more diversified, and more resilient model. What I mean is the following. We're familiar with the concept of one company town from the early days of industrialization, where you have a relatively small city, and sometimes a medium or good-sized city. You have one large company developing its activities there, and then you have the development of an entire ecosystem of suppliers that are all dependent on that one large company. And then the moment that one large company goes down, the entire town goes down. Whereas what we're seeing with Xometry could be a situation where a large company like BMW comes to town, but they will source a lot of their parts elsewhere. So you're not going to have the development of an ecosystem of suppliers locally, which is negative in the short term when everything goes well. But if it forces you to develop other economic activities, you're going to be in a better position if BMW, God forbid, goes bankrupt or decides to pack up and leave and move to another state.
Yeah, no, I think actually that's a great point. So on the one hand, the BMWs and the, call them the primary manufacturers just for the purposes of this conversation, if the primary manufacturers have a portfolio of manufacturing options, it's better for them. But the secondary manufacturers, the guys with the flexibility, the flexible space on their product, their production lines, they also have to develop a portfolio of options, and the towns that house them have to themselves encourage manufacturing with a portfolio of options. And then I could see this type of system really having a sort of a virtuous reinforcing cycle. One of the things that I was thinking about just a few minutes ago when we were talking about advanced manufacturing in developing countries, at GE, the first, quote, brilliant manufacturing plant they had was in Pune in India. And the idea was that not only was it, you know, the most advanced machinery that GE had at the time, might still be, it wasn't that long ago, but also that they were eventually going to go towards a flexible production line system where the plant, unlike some of the other plants which made, you know, just this gas turbine or just that steam turbine or just that wind turbine, it would make a variety of different things. I think that sort of flexible production line, like they had in Pune, kind of has to be the future of manufacturing generally. You know, this is one of these areas where having the 3D CAD drawings and all of your machines able to read those CAD drawings and produce as many parts as it can within the physics of the machine, of the production machine, you know, that's where you really begin to see a major fundamental shift in how things get built.
But does that also then go against the Zometry model? Does it imply that if by production, and by me I mean any company, is mostly centered on very flexible 3D printing machines which can produce many different parts, does it imply that it's actually a lot easier for me to produce any kind of part that I need instead of trying to figure out where can I source it? In a sense, it sounds like as long as my machines, my 3D printers are not running all the time for my main production, I don't need an additional investment. I already have the spare capacity myself.
Well, you might, I guess, a few things. And one is that you may have the flexibility of configuration, but you might not have the flexibility of movement on your line. You might be booked up. You might not have enough machines to make something, which I gather is part of the business that Zometry has. It's not so much that BMW or other manufacturers who contract with them can't do the thing. They sometimes just don't have the ability to make the parts in the time needed. So that's part of my answer. But it's not just about 3D printing. The flexibility in Pune isn't just 3D printing flexibility. It's manufacturing flexibility generally. I met with Randy separately. I'm mentoring a startup as part of a program I'm involved with through George Washington. And with my mentee, I went out to Randy's shop to meet with him. And he said something which I hadn't fully appreciated. He said, the current generation of 3D printers are actually a little finicky. Even the best ones are a little finicky. And because you need to make something to spec, once you get your machine, your 3D printer to make that part the right way, you kind of don't want to use it for anything else because you have to then requalify the machine. And once you know your machine does this thing, that's what it's going to be used for. And so which was surprising to me. I mean, it means that there's, although we think of that sort of magic machines that, you know, you press a button and it's a sneaker one day and the next day it's a tank. It's not quite that magical yet.
They sound more and more like humans. In principle, we can do many things, but you know, once we get stuck on doing one thing, right, that's it.
Right.
What?
Need a job retraining program for the 3D printers.
What do we think of the implications? And now I'm here, I'm thinking of bringing together the geopolitics and the economics of this. Once something like the Zoometry platform becomes more widely used, I'm still worried about protectionism. I'm still worried, and not worried that the Zoometry platform itself might cause more protectionism or more isolation because of what we said before, but can it lower the perceived cost of protectionism and so lead politicians to be even more willing to embrace protectionism?
Lower the perceived cost. Yeah, I mean, I tried to get at this at one point in the interview. I think we might have edited it out and because it wasn't a particularly useful dialogue. I think that's right. I think it could lower the perceived costs of protectionism because, yeah, hey, look, I can make this here. I don't need to rely on you making it elsewhere. The platform itself and the business model itself doesn't directly lead to protectionism, but I think it can be an impetus to protectionist impulses. And that's the fear I have too, that the more, just like with business process outsourcing or any kind of offshoring, the more you give people the ability to make things elsewhere, the more worrisome it becomes that you lose jobs, even if the reality is a more robust trade and more efficient markets and all the things that, you know, we like about trade. The political reality is that people get scared.
The other thing that I thought was interesting in the discussion, and it is germane to the problem of where things can be made, was the point on infrastructure, was the sobering reminder that the basic infrastructure on, Randy was mentioning power supply, but it's also the issue of transportation for merchandise. It becomes more and more important the more you rely on platforms like this, and it's falling apart around us.
That's right. I mean, he mentioned specifically reliable power and how you can't have any power interruptions or even voltage drops or things like that. But it's also, once you have this more complicated supply chain, right? Once you're able to produce things in multiple places, you also need more transportation hubs to get from point A to point Z, and you need, potentially more ports or maybe even specialized ports built. You might be able to make a huge thing in, a random spot in the world, but if that random spot isn't near a port with one of those massive cranes, well, it might be stranded. It does create different challenge, different set of challenges, I think. Of course, building infrastructure has all sorts of follow-on benefits too. It shouldn't, the need to build infrastructure shouldn't in and of itself be seen as something bad, right? That's usually a good thing, but we are maybe too quick to leap to this magical world where you can build anything everywhere.
No, I would be very positive and very happy if I saw the infrastructure being built. What worries me is that I see it crumbling.
Right. Well, it's crumbling here. It doesn't exist in other places.
The last point that keeps going through my mind is that Zoometry is one piece of a very profound change that is beginning to happen in manufacturing. And the other pieces you have mentioned, like 3D printing, there is at the same time the disruption of several of the manufacturing sectors, the efficiency impact that comes from many of the industrial internet innovations. I find the discussion fascinating because I think the manufacturing sector of the future, say 10 years from now, will be very different from the one that we've been used to thinking about over the past 10 years. And one thing that I am hoping for, but actually quite convinced that we will see, is a revival of manufacturing. And now I'm thinking on the economics of it. If you look at the statistics in the US, for example, the share of manufacturing in GDP has been declining for a while. And it's actually quite low. So the economy has become overly dependent on services. And I feel that some of these innovations, including something like the Zometry platform, will be instrumental to turning this around. I think something interesting is that over the coming 10 years, we might actually see manufacturing coming back and becoming again a bigger portion both of GDP and of employment.
I think some of that is going to be, I mean, yes, if it's if it has the positive effect on capacity utilization that we expect it to have. No, if it has the effect on, or maybe less clear, if it has the effect that we were talking about earlier on a broader geographic base of manufacturing. If again, it enables manufacturers to more easily make stuff in other parts of the world, then who knows? I mean, it might have sort of a positive effect on global manufacturing. I think it kind of remains to be seen. Although it's interesting, you know, I don't know how the NAICS or SIC codes would count Zometry itself for things that it doesn't make, but facilitates. I guess that's a service, not manufacturing.
Yes, and that's another point that you and I have discussed in the past. That is, some of these innovations are now blurring the lines between manufacturing and services.
So right.
The traditional distinction becomes less meaningful.
Right, right. In our conversation with Greg Mulholland from Citrine Informatics, the word agile came up a lot, and how companies can be agile. And it, you know, a few different contexts. But one of the things that I think Zometry and manufacturing as a service will do almost by definition is make manufacturing, you know, make big companies more agile. Not just because it'll do what it's already doing. In other words, allow them to produce things using multiple production lines that they may or may not own, but it'll enable their long-term planning to be more agile. And that actually, I think, maybe is one of the keys, and, you know, key uncertainty also, because we don't really know how that will play out. But giving companies the ability for long-term trade-offs of capital investment versus OPEX, I think is itself an agility-enabling service.
I agree completely. That's a very good point.
I think that's it.
And that's all we have.
Want to wrap us up, take us home?
Yes. So once again, we hope that you've enjoyed this back and forth between Michael and me. Let us know if this back and forth has triggered any more thoughts in your mind, any more questions, any more desires for follow-up discussions, topics, and whether you find it useful or not. Because as I pointed out before, it's Michael and I talking to each other is kind of painful, so we hope it's good. If it's not, let us know. But thanks again for listening.
Very nice.